Thank you. Please be seated. This morning we have two causes on our oral submission docket. They are Bostrom Seating Incorporated versus Crane Carrier Company from Nueces County and the 13th Appellate Judicial District, and R.R. Street and Company versus Pilgrim Enterprises Incorporated and others from Harris County and the 1st Appellate Judicial District. Each side has 20 minutes to present argument. The petitioner may reserve a portion of that time for rebuttal. These arguments are being recorded by the clerk of the court, and you may purchase a tape for a nominal fee. We will take a recess in between the arguments. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Boston versus Crane.
May it please the court, Mr. Clay Colton will present argument for the petitioner. Petitioner is reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The primary issues in this case is whether product manufacturers have the right to seek statutory indemnity from its component part suppliers under Section 82.002 of the Civil Practice and Remedies Code, and whether a manufacturer has the right to seek common law indemnity from a component part supplier under the common law. Both of these issues are matters of first impression for this court. I'd like to start by discussing statutory indemnity. And then I'd like to talk about whether there's any right of common law indemnity, and if time permits, I'll discuss whether there was any evidence of a defect in this case. The issue presented with respect to statutory indemnity is whether Crane is a seller for purposes of the product liability statute. And when you look at the Court of Appeals opinion, Court of Appeals didn't look beyond the definition of seller contained in the statute. It didn't construe the entire act. It merely looked at the definition of seller and reached the simplistic conclusion that, well, it placed the garbage truck in the stream of commerce, so it must have been a seller. And it's certainly our position before this court that the issue in this case is a lot more complicated.
Your position is that in these circumstances, the manufacturer of the truck could never get statutory indemnity against a component parts.
That's my reading of the statute. I think when you look at the statute, a good starting place in looking at this particular question is not the definition of seller in 82.0013, but instead 82.002D, which provides that for purposes of this section, and you'll remember that's the section that allows indemnification, a wholesale distributor or retail seller who completely or partially assembles a product in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions shall be considered a seller.
But you think the statute has to be informed by the common law?
Well, I think the court can look at the common law as it existed in 1993 to determine what the legislature meant by the provision.
And you think under the common law, you could, the truck manufacturer could get indemnity?
Well, our position is that under the common law, then as now, the truck manufacturer could not get.
If the truck manufacturer were totally innocent.
It's our position that when this court and B&B basically changed the rules of common law indemnity, it narrowed the scope of indemnity to basically limit the right of indemnification to the innocent retailer or mere conduit in the stream of commerce. And it's our position that that does not include someone who manufactures a product, certainly somebody in the position of Crane.
But you think if the truck manufacturer put the seat in, there was nothing wrong with the truck, and if the only defect that injured the plaintiff was a defect in the seat itself, And in that situation, the truck manufacturer was completely innocent that he could not get indemnity against the seat manufacturer.
That's how I read the current state of Texas common law to be, and certainly that's how I read the statute.
In B&B Auto Supply, didn't the court expressly exclude and not address situations of strict liability? It limited that case to only negligence cases.
Well, I don't interpret B&B to be a strictly a negligence situation. Certainly, in subsequent cases, this court has reiterated over and over that the right of indemnification is limited to the innocent retailer in vicarious liability context.
Are you suggesting that subsequent authority is different from B&B? Because B&B expresses no opinion whether the holding extends to strict liability. Only relates to negligence.
Well, I believe that it's certainly buttressed by all of the repeated statements by this court that the right of common law indemnity is extremely limited and only applies in those two contexts, that being the innocent retailer and purely vicarious liability context. But when you look at the wording of Section 82.02D, I think there's no, if you buy Crane's argument that this statute is broad enough to make any manufacturer entitled to statutory indemnity from its component parts suppliers, I think you'd have to conclude that subpart D of 82.02 has no meaning whatsoever. In our opinion, that provision is basically setting the limits of what the legislature believed a seller could be in terms of its level of involvement with respect to the product. And of course, it talks about a wholesale distributor or retail seller who completely or partially assembles a product in accordance with the manufacturer's instructions, that being within the definition of seller. That being the case, Crane clearly does not fall within that definition. It's much more than just an assembler of a product in accordance with Bostrom's instructions. It built an entire garbage truck. And of course, when you look at that language and then you go to the definition of seller within Section 82.013, I think that helps clarify what the legislature was trying to say when it defined the term seller.
And is it your position that seller and manufacturer are mutually exclusive?
Yes, Your Honor, actually it is my position. And I think
you can't be both at the same time.
For purposes of 82.002, the indemnification provision, I don't think they can be. And I think the Court of Appeals erred in just generically concluding what you can be both. I think when you look at the definition or the statement in 82.002D, that what the legislature was trying to do by that statement was tell everybody that you can't be both a seller and a manufacturer at the same time. And they were trying to create the division line between the two at that level where they're saying a wholesale distributor or retail seller who assembles under the instructions of the manufacturer, will be considered a seller.
But the purpose of the statute, since the plaintiff, the injured consumer, let's say, can pick whoever they want to sue, and they're going to sue somebody local, keep it out of federal court, etc. The purpose of the statute is to make whoever designed the thing wrong, they ought to bear the loss, right? Rather than just who the consumer chose to sue.
Well, I think when you look
at... So if the answer to that is yes, that's why the statute's here. So that just because you sue your local car dealership, if they had nothing to do with designing the Ford defectively, the person who did design it defectively, it's to shift the expense to them, right?
Well, in Fitzgerald, this court specifically said, from looking at the statute, it looked like the purpose of it was to basically protect small sellers from problems, that they had no control over. And I think that under that analysis,
innocent retailers.
That would be an innocent retailer. That would not be a manufacturer such as Crest.
So if there's an innocent manufacturer, why wouldn't the policy be just the same?
Well,
I concede if the situation where the manufacturer should have tested, they took a lawnmower machine, put it in an airplane. They should have known that wasn't going to work. They're not innocent, though. But if they are innocent, we're only looking here at somebody who is innocent. If it's an innocent manufacturer, why should they bear the loss?
Well, certainly one of the considerations that the legislature had when it was enacting the statute was the relative bargaining power of the parties.
I don't see anything in the statute about how big they are.
Well, it doesn't talk about how big they are, but I think if you look at the underlying legislative history, it makes it pretty clear that it was concerned about the retailer who basically has nothing to do with the creation and production of the product, but it ends up with a large legal bill for having to defend itself in a lawsuit.
And innocent manufacturers who assembled a component part that was defective, but they were innocent. They had no reason to suspect, didn't suspect. It's just tough. They just have to bear the loss.
Well, certainly in this case, I think, again, if you look at the definition of or the limitation put in there on 82.02D, they're basically saying that this doesn't extend to a manufacturer of that nature. It's basically saying it extends to someone at the furthest ends of the spectrum who assembled the product in accordance with the instructions of the product manufacturer.
You say the answer to this is contribution.
Well, that's one answer.
Or contract.
Or you could do it by contractual indemnity. That's right.
But in a contribution action, you couldn't get attorney fees, could you?
No, you could not.
So it's not really the answer.
Just
trying to get your attorney fees, really, and having to defend the case.
Well, it's a remedy. Crane has suggested in his briefing that it's just completely without a remedy here. And I think the reality is that contribution provides a remedy, just as it provides a remedy in a general negligence auto case where somebody else is involved in causing an accident.
But it doesn't provide the remedy of attorney fees that the statute provides.
Right. Anyway, against the backdrop of this question of the meaning of Section 82.102D, I think you've got to look at the wording of the definition itself. And the legislature chose to use the words in the business of distributing. It's certainly our position that by using that term, they were trying to address someone other than a manufacturer. They're talking about people who are in the business of passing along products, and therefore we think that to the extent that the definition goes on to talk about placing products in the stream of commerce, what the legislature was talking about was a situation such as where it might not quite be considered a distribution, or there might be some question about whether it's a distribution such as a bailment or a rental or something like that. It was never intended to extend the definition of seller all the way out to a manufacturer. And I think when you look at those definitions and then you go beyond that and look at the legislative history and the consequences of the particular construction, I think you come to the conclusion that the statute was never intended to cover a manufacturer against a component parts supplier.
What would be the legislative thinking in excluding that if it was the component parts supplier that was at fault?
Well, I think the thinking is that the manufacturer is big enough and sophisticated enough to look after its own interests and protect itself from these things. I think you could argue that there's a public policy reason for not giving a manufacturer under this sort of indemnification, especially where the legislature has put the burden of proof basically on the party from whom indemnity is being sought to prove that there's nothing wrong with or that the other party wasn't at fault.
But I suppose there are manufacturers like Specialty Vehicles buy chassis or motors from General Motors, somebody who's much bigger than they are. Why should they? That reasoning doesn't work there.
Well, I think in any event, when you commit to design and manufacture something, no matter how big you are, I think the reality is that you go into it with your eyes wide open. You select your components, and you're better able to assess your risk than a product retailer who basically buys things and then sells them on the shelf. It wasn't involved in the planning. And I think, frankly, if you want to talk about the public interest, if you put this burden on a component part supplier, it gives the manufacturer every reason in the world to care less about safety, because they figure at the end of the day, if they can join the component part supplier, they can just simply let them worry about it.
Not if a jury finds them 1% individually negligent, right?
Well, if there's some independent responsibility, right. But if, like in this case, where it's a dubious products liability case to begin with from the plaintiff's perspective, the manufacturer, the component part supplier, they all prevail, what happens? Bostrom Seating just bought Crane's $225,000 legal bill, even though there were all kind of other allegations in the case against Crane that have nothing to do with Bostrom.
What's the status of the case? Did the plaintiff's case go back to trial?
My understanding is it's been abated and it's just in limbo, waiting to see what happens in this case. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. The court is ready to hear argument from the sponsor.
May it please the court, Mr. Brock,
One didn't seem to bring in Bostrom or Bostrom as a third party defendant.
I did.
But you get there. If this case gets back to trial, and they appeal.
Procedurally, it's cattywampus, but it's not my fault. I third partied in Bostrom and Beams. Two component part manufacturers. Beams manufactured the seat belt. Bostrom manufactured the seat. They were not originally sued by plaintiffs, among other reasons, because we were sued on the eve of the passing of the statute of limitations. I brought them in after the plaintiff's expert identified the seat and the seat belt as the two component parts that were at issue. At trial, at the close of the plaintiff's case, plaintiffs joined in the motion for directed verdict of both Bostrom and Beams. And the court, despite the same arguments I'm making here today, granted those motions.
Why isn't there a collateral estoppel problem with that ruling by the trial court?
Well, there would be, except it's not final. I mean, and then...
But, I mean, you're having this little procedure here. If the trial judge sought to unabate it and made a final judgment there, that would...
Then they severed here. That's how we got here. And Beams did not appeal. Or Beams did not sever. They stayed. Making it interlocutory, because at the trial, it was a case mistried. The jury was out for 6 days, and finally mistried. And after the mistrial, Bostrom severed in order to make their judgment final, forcing me to appeal.
Okay, Bostrom severed the motion for directed verdict they got.
Yes.
Is that on appeal?
That's this.
I thought this was an indemnity action separate from.
No, complaint of the trial courts dismissing them from the lawsuit, including my ability to keep
for both contribution and indemnity.
Yes.
Okay. Well,
if
sometimes the breaks the
if there were the petitioner raises the argument that it would be difficult to apportion responsibility if there were multiple component manufacturers at fault. What's your response to that?
Yeah, you know, on the patent jury committee, think about those sorts of things, and absolutely, it becomes part of the test of evidence. And if indeed there are different component parts that are at stake, I believe that all need to be properly allocated, ultimately in separate issues, so that those comparative responsibilities, to the extent that they are, indeed comparative, depending on the findings.
But under your theory of the statute, there could be liability there, but no prescribed way of apportioning.
The statute clearly does not prescribe,
and nothing else does either. You know.
Not that I know of. I mean, the only guidance that I can think of is the manner in which, for instance, in other indemnity actions, a second set of questions is asked.
Has the burden in the indemnity action? How is the burden of proof allocated? The petitioner's concerned about the effect of Meritor and Fixture on this.
I believe that those cases stand for the proposition that once it is established that a party is a manufacturer, or in this case, a component part manufacturer, the burden then shifts to them.
So that becomes the component part manufacturer's burden to prove that it was truck manufacturer's assembly that was defective and not their part.
Yes.
But that's only triggered by a simple pleading by the truck manufacturer, right? I mean, all they have to do is say, we want indemnity, and the burden shifts. That seems sort of odd. In Meritor and Fitzgerald, it was the plaintiff's pleading that triggers the burdens between the product handlers, distributors, sellers, manufacturers. And that's one thing, but to have one of the people in the chain trigger it as between themselves just by filing a pleading, it seems awfully strange. You say, I want indemnity, and all of a sudden the defendant has got to disprove that you're entitled to.
Well, I don't have a good answer to that, other than to suggest that between, as Justice Brister mentions, between a manufacturer who is responsible for the product itself that is at issue and someone who is a purchaser and thereby a seller of that product, placing it into commerce, that burden ought to lay at the doorstep of the party. The clear intent of the statute is to impose on those parties who are manufacturing and fabricating products those additional responsibilities, not be in a position to sell those off to someone else.
But it just seems to me it would go a long way to solving some of the problems the petition raises. If the truck manufacturer had to prove that it was a seat that was defective and not the manufacturing process of the truck. And ordinarily, you would think, in order to cover party seeking, affirmative relief would have to prove.
Yes. But then my fallback position in this case is our right to common law indemnity, that indeed the facts of this case clearly indicate that there is evidence to these folks into and before the trial, in fact, that evidence coming from the mouth of plaintiff's own expert as to the seed itself. He came up with four specific complaints about the seat, the headrest, the lack of armrest, the contour of the seat. I can never keep all four in mind. And then concludes that this seat is not suitable for use in any product, any place, because of these defects. That is surely enough evidence.
Take me back to the trial. Then the plaintiff throws this evidence in saying that's why the seat manufacturer should not be okay.
No, what happened was that on deposition, their expert, and my mom said don't say anything about individuals unless you say quick things. Their expert did a flip because in his deposition, he comes up with all these defects and problems consistent with his report in the seat and says, no, this seat isn't suitable under any circumstances. And then at trial, says, oh, no, what I really meant, because I don't want these other local corpus lawyers to be ganging up on me. I want everybody to be focusing on Akers and his client. That what I really was interested in and what I really meant was that the whole design of the seating configuration in this cab, the seat's okay as it is, but where Crane puts it in the cab is wrong, and that's the defective design. So the evidence that I have in the record that ought to have kept them in the trial was my cross-examination of their expert reciting to him the things that he told me in his deposition. The reason that I brought that out being that he was doing his 180-degree flip, and in my view, it dramatically affected his credibility.
And if the trial judge had not granted the directed verdict, we would have found out which one the jury of those two the jury believed, if either, was defective, right?
Exactly.
Or both.
Sure.
And then it's your position that if the jury allocated it anything other than 100 to nothing, you're not going to get into it. If the jury puts 99% on Boston and 1% on you, that's the end of your indemnity claim.
Yes.
But if it were 100 to nothing, then you would get into automatically, or is there some other showing? Is there another step in here?
No, I don't think there is.
I mean, once the jury comes back with a verdict and the trial court accepts it, then you, under your reading of the statute, you can tell whether you're going to get nothing or contribution or indemnity.
I don't think the statute clearly gives us that sort of guidance, but I think that your scenario it would be the probable result. That is,
this is what you had in mind. You brought out a third-party action for contribution and indemnity both.
Yes, absolutely.
And that's your vision.
Even if
the statute isn't clear, that's...
Yeah, my vision was that they're saying that these component parts are at fault. I need them in the party and defending their product and being responsible.
So you asserted a claim for contribution at trial?
Yes.
What's the status of that claim?
Oh, well, it was dismissed. So
contribution claim at the same time as the indemnity claim?
Yes.
On directed verdict? Do you consider your client a retailer?
Well, actually, I do. My client is, in actuality, more of an assembler than it is a manufacturer. They buy a General Motors chassis, put it on another manufacturer's motor. The garbage truck part is manufactured by somebody else. They are indeed, in many respects, an assembler of a series of component products.
Does the purchaser have any choice about these products? In other words, are these special, made special to order, and they say, I want a Ford chassis, Oldsmobile?
As a matter of fact, yes. The city of Corpus Christi was the purchaser they specified this particular seat, among other features.
So that's why you see yourself more just like a Walmart with products.
Well, that's how I can say with a straight face that we are something of an assembler. Obviously, it says Crane Carrier on it, and there's a manufacturing process that goes with it. And indeed, we assemble and put all of these things together. I mean, it is an integrated system. Among the complaints, for instance, was the seat belt. The seat belt and its locations are directed by the directions from the seat manufacturer. So in many, many respects, we are only doing what the manufacturer tells us to do as we assemble.
I asked about whether you consider your client to be a retailer. You said your client was more of an assembler than a manufacturer.
But and
is your client a retailer?
We are a retailer, absolutely.
Or is it a wholesaler, or does that make a difference?
Let me tell you why
I'm interested. The House report on the statute, a couple of parts, uses retailers and sellers, apparently interchangeably, not throughout, but in a couple of paragraphs. Does that make a difference to your case, whether it's a retailer or a wholesaler?
I don't think so. I think the recitations that were spoken about as to the legislative history, that the simplistic concept of the legislature, and I don't mean to suggest that they're simplistic, but that when this is probably enacted, they are probably thinking more in terms of Walmart than they are thinking in terms of General Motors, and that makes sense. But I do believe, absolutely, that when General Motors or Crane buys a product, puts it in, buys it whole, and uses it, and then distributes it, places it in the stream of commerce, that indeed it becomes a seller and a placer into the stream of commerce of that particular product.
Turning to the evidence for a moment, the only testimony that I've read is the Stilson testimony attached to the petition. And you go through your brief and say their expert, at least this deposition, as you brought out across it, the seat was defective in certain ways. But is there any evidence in the record how these defects caused the injury in this case?
Yes. The this is a flip over where a car jumps out in front of Mr. Gonzalez. It's a rainy day. He swerves. It flips over three times, and he goes up and down and around, and gets injured in that process. The theory adduced by John Stilson, their expert, is that he was not able to be restrained into the seat. They claimed, against all logic to the contrary, that Mr. Gonzalez was actually wearing his seatbelt at the time, and that somehow or another, the configuration of both the seatbelt and the seat together prevented him from staying in place. Therefore, the armrests, for instance, would have prevented the lateral movement. The contour of the seat might have prevented some of the lateral movement. The headrest might have prevented some of the upward movement, where he is alleged to have what they call submarine somehow or another up above his seat. So yes, the record is very clear.
Record. That's in the trial record.
Mr. Akers, what are the limitations of the definition of seller? If your approach to that definition is correct, in the process of manufacturing, wholesaling, distributing, retailing product, isn't every entity in that chain a seller until you get to perhaps the raw manufacturer or the raw product seller? For instance, the entity that sold the material that covered that Bostrom's Crane, that entity would be a seller. In fact, your approach, Bostrom would be a seller, correct?
No, because they manufactured. Did you say, you mean the foam industry?
Well, let's take one question at a time.
Okay.
Under your approach, what
related to not the design that Bosch was responsible for, but that there was something intrinsic about one of its parts that led to.
I assume that's the case. Then what are the limitations on your definition of seller?
As to the part.
Or do you contend the statute doesn't intend any?
Well, I think that the plain reading is that either you can be a manufacturer, you can be a seller. And since we didn't design, formulate, construct, or rebuild the seat, which comes whole to us, and which is, the design comes to us, but we then place it into our product and put it into the stream of commerce, instead, we become a seller as to that. There are other aspects of the truck that we are sellers of. There are other aspects of the truck that we are manufacturers of because we've designed it, we've formulated it, we've fabricated it.
There was no complaint about the fact that the truck flipped on us in the street. I mean, that there was something, stability.
No, it wasn't a city street. It was a rural area. He was on his way to the dump going 60 miles an hour, and car swerves out, and he turns, and what happens is, because it's a two-lane road, his right two wheels, his passenger side wheels, get over on the side, and he can't control.
So that wasn't part of it. So the complaints, as this thing went to trial, were solely based on problems he had after he started flipping, based on allegations of the way that the seat was.
Yes.
Mr. Crane, Acres, I'm thinking about Crane, unless you want to assume that name.
I haven't seen the balance.
How does Crane typically market or sell their product?
They market their products by way of salespeople. They're a unique market. They go directly to cities like West University and Corpus Christi and market their products directly.
Mostly to governmental units?
Yes, because they're the biggest purchasers.
Responding to bids, or do they actually have salespeople go out and solicit bids?
Both.
Thanks.
Any other questions? Thank you, Council.
Let me clear up something that I think may be steering y'all in the wrong direction. That is, there is no contribution claim in this case. I think if you go look at the pleading that Mr. Akers filed, it talks about two things. It talks about statutory indemnity under Section 82. It talks about common law indemnity. There's not a word mentioned in it about contribution. And therefore, that's why our motion for directed verdict deals with those issues.
And the plaintiff never cross-claimed against the seat.
Never did. And, you know, I think there's some insinuation that there's something under the table going on between Bostrom and plaintiffs in this case. And the fact of the matter is, when you read the record, you see what the plaintiff and his expert are contending all along is, it's not the seat in and of itself that's the problem. It's the way the seat's used in connection with this cab Crane design.
They don't waive anything about indemnity, right, if they don't pursue contribution, right? Just because
right.
They've chosen to go for all or nothing doesn't mean they absolutely get nothing.
Well, I think if indemnity is all or nothing, and if you don't plead for contribution, you wouldn't have the opportunity to get contribution.
Right, but it wouldn't affect indemnity.
Right. I mean, it doesn't impact it one way or another. It's just one less claim for y'all to worry about. But anyway, it's been portrayed up here as being a simple matter of the seat belt and the seat. And I think when you look at the deposition of, the trial testimony of Stilson and the plaintiff's arguments in this case, they were complaining a lot more.
Well, are you saying there's no evidence?
I'm saying there's no evidence.
That's directed verdict. We read through the record. There's absolutely no evidence that the seat belt or the seat played any role in his injury?
Well, the seat belt's not an issue here because the seat belt manufacturer isn't for this court. But I'm saying that there's no evidence that that seat was defective in and of itself, and therefore there can be no liability under common law indemnity if this court finds that there is such a right of common law indemnity. I think that's the first hurdle the plaintiffs have to overcome is you've got a first show, Crane falls within the concept of common law indemnity, and then and only then do you get to this question about, was there a defect? But when you're looking at the evidence, you'll see that this isn't just about the seat. It's about the height of the roof, which, of course, Bostrom would have had no control over. It's about the metal engine box that the plaintiff allegedly hits his head on when he goes sideways. It's about the lack of padding on the roof. There's a lot of things in this case that have nothing to do with Bostrom. But as we interpret this, what Crane's attempting to do through indemnity, they're trying to shift the entire burden of this case, all the cost of this case, onto our client, even though our client's role in it is small. Certainly, in our opinion, there's no defect at all.
Who is Mr. Stilson in this case?
Mr. Stilson is the plaintiff's automotive expert.
Did the briefing indicates that he, as an expert, condemned the design of the seat for at least four reasons? Failure to have a headrest, failure to have a contour, etc. You contend none of that testimony constitutes legally sufficient evidence?
Well, I contend several things. One, we certainly argue that it didn't rise to the level of a defect under the definition of design defect under the Civil Practice and Remedies Code. But two, when you look at his testimony, he says repeatedly, I'm not complaining about the seat in and of itself. I'm talking about it as used in this particular application. And as such, it's our belief that under the component part doctrine, we cannot be liable because what he's saying is this seat is perfectly good for some purposes. It just shouldn't have been used in this particular application. And under the component part doctrine, that makes us innocent and we have no liability.
Is the armrest testimony and the headrest and all of that that Mr. Akers was talking about, is that in the trial?
It is in the record.
She didn't attach it to you.
I may not have it in the appendix. I will say that in terms of that, we did make models. In fact, this particular model, you could have gotten a headrest, you could have gotten the armrest. That was a decision Crane made not to take this. In any event, we believe there's no right of indemnity in this case. We believe that the trial court got it right and the court feels ought to be reversed. Thank you.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument.